And welcome to the Food and Agricultural Policy Summit, brought to you by Farm Journal and the Farm Foundation. My name is Roger Bernard. I'm with Farm Journal. I'll be one of your moderators for this rather historic event today here in Washington, D.C. First, I'd like to introduce the panelists that we have with joining us. We have former Secretary and now Senator-elect Mike Johanns, serving under the George W. Bush administration from 2005 to 2007. Next to him, former Secretary Ann Veneman. She served in the Bush administration from 2001 to 2005. Former Secretary Dan Glickman, under the Bill Clinton administration, serving from 1995 to 2001. Next to him, former Secretary of Agriculture Mike Espy, who served from 1993 to 1994. Clayton Yeider served under the George H.W. Bush administration from the year 1989 to 1991. And Jack Block, under the administration of Ronald Reagan, serving from 1981 to 1986. Three of the former living Secretaries of Agriculture are unable to join us this afternoon. Clifford Hardin, who is in Nebraska, served in the Nixon administration from 1969 to 1971, and John Kniebel, who served from November of 96 to January of 1977 in the Gerald Ford administration. Also unable to join us is, from the Carter administration, Bob Berglund, who served from 1977 to 1981. However, he is present with us on videotape. The other moderator that we have this evening is the distinguished gentleman from Texas, former Representative Charlie Stenholm. And with that, we'd like to begin our conversation with the secretaries.
First question, and this one will go to Bob Berglund, and we will hear his answer. What advice would you offer the next secretary on farm and trade policy issues that fall under USDA's umbrella? Bob?
The world is changing so fast that it's impossible to keep up. But what is known is that the world markets are changing. In my day, most of the world outside of Europe and Japan was kind of a third world income. Poor people didn't have money. They'd barter, they'd trade, they'd buy what they could. Mostly they depended on donations and gifts from the United States through various agencies. Now that's all changed. China and India have just come alive. These are enormous countries, and four and five times the population of the United States, and now about a quarter to a third of their population has joined the middle class. They're reforming their economies. They're in the market to buy. They pay cash, and they're huge and growing. And so the markets are shifting dramatically in this Department of Agriculture has to keep track of those things, and so their contacts are going to be broadened to the Department of State and other internationally aligned federal agencies to be informed on what's taking place in the real world.
Jack?
On that same question.
Same question. What advice would you offer the next secretary?
I think the next Secretary of Agriculture, the first thing that he needs to do is very quickly put together his lead team, because experience tells me that if you don't, later on you're going to be told who your lead team is, because there are a lot of people that worked on the campaign. They're going to be looking for jobs, and you know the campaign and the party's going to say, well, take care of so and so. And that's one thing I did very quickly is went out and rounded up a team. I think the team ought to be a team working for the secretary with the experience that fits the jobs that they're in. I really think that you want to be sure that since the Department of Agriculture spends more money on food and nutrition than anything else, you better have that base properly covered. And then on farm programs, be sure you got some farmers. Cover the bases that you're talking about. That's the first thing you do. And you're going to be faced with challenges on farm programs. They're going to be cutting out the spending, and you're going to have to deal with that. And I don't want to get into that, but the first thing is put your team together and make sure you've got a good team that will work for you. And I also say Don't come in there with the idea that, nobody's going to do things my way or anything like that. There's a great team at the Department of Agriculture, career people, that'll help you, and you're going to get the job done. You just have to work with them.
Clayton, you've had experience both on the Secretary of Ag side and also the trade representative side. So your advice on the Secretary of issues that fall under USDA's umbrella?
Well, thanks, Charlie. There are going to be a couple of the major policy issues that are going to hit his desk very quickly, in fact, instantaneously. And one of his challenges is going to be to make sure we got a place to sell products that are grown on American farms. And that, to me, that leads immediately to two quick policy issues. One is energy, because the renewable fuels issue is going to be hotter than a pistol going into next year. There'll be energy legislation coming up on the Hill, as you well know, and the Secretary of Agriculture has got to do his part to try to preserve the opportunities to continue to develop renewable fuels as a source of demand for American farm products. On the trade policy scene, with all the financial turmoil that we have right now, Charlie, one of the real risks is countries beginning to shut down their marketplaces. And it's not only a matter of trying to grow additional market opportunities around the world through the Doha round or bilateral negotiations, we're going to make sure that we don't lose markets that are already available to us. And the Secretary is going to have to weigh in on those issues along with the U.S. Trade Representative. And there's a lot of that going on right now with countries beginning to pull back as a result of the financial turmoil. I don't happen to think that's in their interest or our interest. But, boy, is it appealing in these kinds of circumstances, and somebody has to counter that.
Mike, any views you'd add to that?
I think that what I would advise a new secretary in out of position of the department in very difficult times is to try to position the department to do more with less. And I speak right now in terms of in the budgetary context. We are officially in a recession, even though now we have a new farm bill and we're proud of that, and many of the programs were continued and extended, those programs have to be funded. And I think that with a lot of the publicity we've had lately about, millionaire farmers and so forth, I think that many farmers out there will find that they have literally a target on their backs when it comes to funding a lot of these programs. So I've got to say that the secretary has a position department to do more with less. And that's really in line with what Clayton just said, to actually pry open new markets, to pry open new markets. We in this country, as we all know, are incredibly, incredibly productive. But we produce more than we can consume domestically. And so we always have stocks there, and we always have to find new markets to promote those stocks. And so those markets are China, those markets are in India. They're becoming greater, they have greater incomes. Their people now are buying chicken and other protein. But we have to be able to have the right multilateral treaties, to reinstitute Doha Round, to make sure that we can get into those markets. So the way we do more with less is to sell through the private market into those countries.
Dana, listening to these, a little different twist of the question to you is, how do we manage to export more of what we grow and import less of what our competitors would like to sell up to us?
Well, first of all, I figured you'd give me a twist because I sat next to him for
get
all those years,
right?
But I'm gonna respond just quickly by answering the first question.
Yes,
because
sir.
The first thing you do is keep your sense of humor, because every day is a challenge, and if you don't do that, you're dead. Second thing you do is you go meet your employees, walk through the halls of the place to let them know you're there and alive, and you need their help. The third thing you do is you make contact with all the key members of Congress that you have to deal with, because they will be probably more important for your survival than anybody else around. And because farm policy tends to be as much congressionally dictated, as you know, as any other form of policy here. So those are kind of a couple practical steps. The fourth thing is we're in a kind of period of national emergency right now, so I think the most pressing challenge for a new secretary is to how to use the nutrition programs in the department to feed hungry people during difficult recessionary time periods. And we've seen, we'll see probably unequaled demand for food stamps, school lunch, WIC, and all those other programs. And this new secretary had better be ready to get those programs up, running, well-managed, quite frankly, under the leadership of Mike and Ed Schaefer, those programs have done very, very well. But that would be the real pressure point right now, quite frankly, is not the farm programs. The real pressure point are the distressed people in this country who are out of work, and we'll have more and more of them as time goes on. And hopefully it'll turn around as quickly as possible and to deal with those particular problems. I just to answer the last thing as quickly as possible, we are in this period of enormous change. And I think it was Clayton or Jack who mentioned China and India. We probably are not going to be in the same kind of supply management world in the future that we've been in the past. And so exporting our farm commodities overseas, they're great opportunities, but they're going to be great challenges by economic dislocations around the world and food fuel issues and the demand for food that we probably haven't seen for a very long time.
Ann?
Which question are you asking me?
The one everybody was supposed to have answered, yeah. But so far only two have done close to answering the question. And that is what thank you for asking me, though, Ann. That's good.
Right.
What advice would you give, offer the next secretary on farm and trade policy issues that fall under USDA's umbrella? That was the question.
Okay. I think, first of all, on trade, agreeing very much with what has been said, but agriculture in the U.S. is one of the most export-dependent industries that the country has, and yet we constantly see the protectionist tendencies in this country growing and growing. People are anti-trade. They want to undermine the trade agreements that we have. And at a time when we've seen the increase in food prices around the world that we saw earlier this year, and the reaction to that has been putting trade policies in place to prohibit the export of products in many countries. This kind of export control at a time of financial crisis and food crisis can only prolong, as we know from Smoot-Hawley, the Great Depression. And so I think one of the biggest things we need to do now is protect ourselves from trade restrictions and expand markets. Because I think it's very important that the next Secretary of Agriculture be one who helps to educate about the importance of trade, particularly in the kind of economic times we're in today, and particularly for the export-dependent industry that we have in food and agriculture. I think on the farm policy side, I think we need to continually look from a public policy perspective on what makes sense for a farm policy of the future. Energy, the price of fuel, the environmental issues, the cost of labor. There's many issues that come into how do you design the best farm policy for the future and for this country.
I'd offer a couple of thoughts, starting out with a trade agenda, if you will. The new administration, working with the Secretary, working with the USTR, really have an opportunity to design what kind of trade agenda they want or don't want. I mean, literally, they start from a clean slate. We have some trade agreements that are yet to be ratified, but very early on, literally inside the Oval Office, President Barack Obama is going to have to decide what does trade mean to this nation. To agriculture, it means a lot. Ann is absolutely right. We're very, very trade dependent. 25% of our income, thereabouts, comes from trade. 50% of our rice is sold into the foreign marketplace. I think 70% of our cotton, row crops, about every third row of corn, soybeans has to find its place in the export market. Cattle, pork, poultry, you could go on and cite the numbers. But ladies and gentlemen, at this point, we do not have trade promotion authority. It expired. That is a huge policy decision for the next president of the United States. If it is his decision to just allow that to continue to be an expired piece of legislation, you will not get a bilateral trade agreement. Why? No country, and I've sat through these trade discussions, will sit there, put all their cards on the table at some point during the discussions, stand up and shake hands and say, we've got a deal, if they know that any member of the House or Senate can amend that deal. In other words, they've shown all their cards. Why would they enter into an agreement that they can't get an up or down vote on? So I would just tell you, if you don't have TPA renewed, you won't have much of a trade policy. The second significant trade issue that they have to face is what to do with the Doha round. That thing has been blessed and buried so many times it's hard to even describe it. But reality is the round is still there. And as the world has struggled financially, we have to decide, again, as a world, what do you do with trade? Any study that has ever been done will tell you that the benefits of the Doha round, the benefits are going to come in lessening the distortion we see in trying to sell our products or other countries selling their products to another nation. So, again, that's an Oval Office call that's not going to be made even at the cabinet level. And then the final thing I would say in terms of trade is this. It is great to talk about the need for better relations with other nations. It is enormously important to have good international relations, diplomacy, and all of the other things that go with that. But I will tell you from experience, the first thing you're going to be asked when you meet with a foreign leader is, are you willing to negotiate with us to open your market to whatever? I don't know what it will be. It depends upon the country and what they grow or manufacture or whatever. If the answer to that question is no, that will have a chilling effect on foreign relations. You can't imagine how often the heads of state from various parts of the world literally talk about a given product raised in a given area that they're trying to sell in another part of the world. Trade is part of what binds nations together, and if your attitude is we can get along without it, we don't need TPA, we don't need the Doha round, it will have a chilling effect on international relations. It may not the first meeting, but it will over time.
Okay. Our next question is, what can be the biggest challenges in a transition between administrations? And again, we will go to Secretary Berglund.
Well, I think cooperation between the senior people of the department, one with the other. When I came in, Earl Butz was very helpful to me. I didn't directly replace him, but I'd known him from my days in the Congress. And he and I, he was kind of a feisty fellow, and he and I didn't always agree. But when I came over to USDA, he was very, very helpful. Dealing with not just so much with policy stuff as with the internal workings of the machinery at the Department of Agriculture. And that kind of help was very much appreciated.
Okay. Secretary Johans, although you were not directly involved in a transition between administrations when you came into your role, from your perspective, though, what are some of those challenges?
Well, there's practical challenges. You start the first day really without a sub-cabinet because the first wave of appointments and approvals by the United States Senate are at the cabinet level. And it takes a while to get your team in place. In fact, you could spend the better part of your first year working to get your team in place. And so that can be a challenge. The second thing is the world doesn't stop. You could have a big trade problem the first week on the job. You could have a country say, well, for whatever reason, we're going to close your border or our border to your poultry. The world just simply does not stop. These issues can be met by effective transition. The transition between Ann and I said today, was seamless. I mean, it just went great. We worked together well. Her team was there, and it just went outstanding. But probably the person who can talk about transition from one administration to another is not Mike Johans. It's some others on the panel, including Ann Veneman, who actually lived through that.
So, Ann, having lived through that.
Having lived through that. Actually, I was the point person as deputy secretary on the transition from the Bush administration to the Clinton administration. So we did it from an outgoing perspective. And then, of course, when we walked in on day one, exactly 8 years later, we were going through another transition. And I think one of the things that's very important to remember about agriculture is it's a very bipartisan issue. And we have an extraordinarily good team of career people at USDA, as you pointed out today. I felt very fortunate because I had been at USDA before and I could walk in on day one and know those career people that were most important, like the chief economist, the chief budget person. These were people that I'd worked with. And so one of the things I think is it's very important to know what career people you can really rely on for good and solid policy advice. The second thing is getting this, you know, the appointments. And it's a combination of what Jack said, and that is, you know, the people that are going to be forced upon you versus those that you have to select and interview and then get them confirmed. I mean, I walked in with a team of four people and myself, and everybody else was gone. There were literally no offices on the secretary's floor that were full when I got there. And I think one of the most important things was having that team. But we did face exactly a very important issue within the first 2 weeks, and that was the mad cow disease in the UK. And we had to scramble. But I knew the person who had been a carryover at the State Department on the ag and economic side, and he got engaged in it. But it was very difficult because we had to engage very quickly. We sent a lot of veterinarians over there to help, and it was tough because we had no sub-cabinet. But I think we managed to get through that fairly well, and we didn't get it in our country. Now, the final thing is it's always nice to leave something for your successor, like a little mustard in the drawer.
She's very thoughtful lady.
Okay, besides That's leaving mustard in the drawer, what else do you do as an outgoing secretary for that transition?
Well, first of all, I'd say that I was fortunate because Mike assembled a very good team. And I kept most of his sub-cabinet the entire time. I was also coming in the middle. I found that when I wanted to replace somebody or when I had an opening, there was less pressure from the White House than there would have been at the beginning of administration. I mean, I would say a couple of things. Number one is that, as everybody has said, get out and immediately get to know your key career people, the most important thing you do. They're going to make you or break you, not your politicals, but your career people. We had, I remember, Steve Dewhurst, Keith Collins, and there are a myriad of them, and some of them are even here today, that there were some of the most outstanding public servants I ever met in my life. They got me through my confirmation hearings, that, of course, is fairly important in this process, or we wouldn't be sitting here in the first place. But that certainly is a big part of it. Second of all, one position, I go back to this Congress thing, because as you see, Charlie Stenholm, make sure you have a good Assistant Secretary for Congressional Affairs. Because I'm telling you, if the second thing that's going to make you or break you are is your relationships with Congress. Now, I, like maybe Charlie and Mike, be too overly focused on that, but it will save your rear end over and over and over again. If you have the confidence of those people on Capitol Hill that you'll listen to them, that you meet with them. And then the third thing is the old Lyndon Johnson quote, which Johnson used to say, the one thing he did before he went home every night was he'd answer his phone calls, every single phone call. Now, you can't answer every phone calls, but don't let any of that stuff lay over. Get it answered. It's particularly with members of Congress, but it's also true with your team out there. And when I left, Ann in a reasonable condition to do what she had to do in building a whole new team that was there. But the department is a wonderful place to work, and sometimes the Department of Agriculture doesn't get the stature that it needs to have. We impact people's lives more than virtually any other department of government, without question, from when they wake up to when they go to sleep. And so the trick is to use your muscle and exercise it prudently and appropriately and in doing so, empower your employees to work with you, starting with your career people, the most important thing you can do.
Secretary Espy, you came in after 12 years of Republican administrations.
Yes.
So that must have presented a different set of challenges. What's your guidance to the next secretary based on your experience?
Have a great relationship with your predecessor. Now, Clayton and I, there's no physical separation up here on the stage, but we do remember today finally Ed Madigan, who was my immediate predecessor.
Exactly.
And Ed is no longer with us, unfortunately. But he and I had a great relationship because we served in the House Committee on Agriculture. And I recall once I was named, I got a call from Ed, and I came up there, and he met me in this huge, panel room, room. The Office of the Secretary, almost as big as this hall that we're in today. And we sat at this big oak table, and we sat there, he on one end and I on the other, and he pulled a note out of his breast pocket, and he slid it across the table. I don't know what it was. Surrender conditions. I don't know what it was. There were six names on that list. And he said, these are the people who you should rely on, once you are here. I said, Ed, there are 124,000 employees at USDA. And you're telling me six people? That only six people I can rely on? But I got to tell you, those six people, and you've already named two of them, Keith Collins and Steve Dewhurst. I elevated Keith Collins to the new position of economist to chief economist to the secretary. Outstanding public servants. Some of them were Republicans and known to be so, and I kept them there because you hunt for good talent, you keep good talent, and sometimes the talent rises above the party, and you have to call some members of Congress and make sure they understand that. But that's how you do it. And lastly, I would say that when it comes to the Congressional Oversight Committees and the members of Congress, pay homage. Pay homage. Go over there. Tell them what you're doing. Make sure that they understand that you're not going to blindside them with anything. I recall that this is a long story. I will truncate it. I thought the department was too large. There's great responsibility in agriculture. I wanted to modernize it. I wanted to reform it. And I thought first that we had to save a little money by cutting offices, and I tried to do that. And there was an article in the Washington Post regarding my intent to close down an office in West Virginia. And I got a call the next day to go meet the senior senator from West Virginia. And I got in the office, and he was sitting there. He was sitting there, and there was a court reporter there to make sure that everything I said was recorded for posterity. His first question was, I read the article yesterday, and he wanted to make sure I understood that the head of that office, the one that I had named, that I intended to close, was a relative of his. And needless to say, that office remains open today.
Guarantee it.
Get good people, keep good people, and make sure you have great relations with the oversight committees and those who sign your budgets in the Congress.
Now, Clayton, you sort of, cheated, if you will, having gone through a transition to U.S. Trade Representative, then moving over in the Bush administration, Bush 1, to head up USDA. From that insight, what's your advice?
Well, I also lived through some of the transitions all the way back to the Nixon and Ford administration, too, so I've had that over and over again. The one at USDA was easy, of course, because Dick Ling was my predecessor, and when you're passing the wand in that manner, that's very simple. It gets a little more dicey, as Mike says, when the passage is from one political party to another. And there it becomes very attitudinal. And the question is, you know, what's the attitude of the people going out and what's the attitude of the people coming in? As you know, particularly in the White House, that got pretty sensitive when the transition took place from the Clinton administration to the Bush administration. I don't think we've ever had that kind of problem, really, at USDA, and I don't think we ever will for all the reasons that people are talking about here. But it does pose at least some very difficult logistical and personnel issues, because some of this is a matter of timing. And if you have an incoming administration that says, you want these guys who have been here out immediately, and sometimes they say that, then you do get a lot of empty offices. And the question then is, you know, how fast is the incoming administration going to fill those offices? Because you can have some really serious gaps, as Ann was talking about a little bit ago. So there, a lot of this is a question of timing. And if there's a great spread between the time an assistant secretary or undersecretary leaves and his successor comes in, that can pose a major, major issue. As Secretary Johans was pointing out, you fill the cabinet officers first, so you don't have the gap there, but you do get the gaps as you go further down. So you've really got to watch that. Other than that, the question is, do you get really good people in those slots? And that sometimes becomes a wrestling match for the White House that will have some ideas about who they'd like to send over. Just to give you a specific example in this administration, I think Secretary Gutierrez came in from the private sector with really no experience in government, and I think he would tell you today quietly he was a dumping ground by the White House in the early days of his tenure as Secretary of Commerce. So what you don't want is to be a dumping ground for the White House, who's trying to put some people farm people out into departments.
As with Secretary Johans, Jack, you came in from outside of Washington, even where the rest of our panelists here were in Washington.
I can't pretend to say that I knew everything about how to do it. I had no idea, but I think it's kind of my nature to have something to do. I just want to get it done, and that's what I did, is to get my team put together. And if you do it quickly, and I reached out, I brought in farmers and other people, and I had a transition team that brought me people to interview. Man, I interviewed five, and I said, I want that one. And before you know it, I had my team picked pretty fast, and that's what you have to do. Another thing that I wanted to mention is that you need to build a relationship with other members of the cabinet. And the White House staff, the people that are really calling the shots. And I didn't, frankly, know anybody in the cabinet. I didn't really know a soul or in the White House, even. And the first cabinet meeting, we had it at the Blair House, so we hadn't even been seated yet. And there we are in the Blair House, and they had an agenda, and President Reagan had cabinet meetings every week, every other week. We had lots of them. But this one here, I thought, you know, the president promised to lift the grain embargo. This is the worst thing hanging over our heads when I came in as secretary. It was all of agriculture, the grain embargo. We can't sell our grain to Russia. And I thought, well, he went through the agenda, and he says, anybody else have anything else? And I said, Mr. President, you promised to lift that grain embargo, and I wonder how soon we can get it done. My God, I almost have my head taken off by Alexandra Haig and Cap Weinberger and some others that we're not going to give that to the Russians. We're going to get something in return. And the point is, I didn't know these others, and I didn't have my team together on that issue. And so I had to go back and start working and talking to, I found out I had allies. I mean, Mac Baldridge is an ally of mine. He was Commerce. He supported me. Bill Brock was an ally of mine, a good ally of mine. And he was trade ambassador. I found out, you got to figure out who your friends are. I found out that Ed Meese was my strongest friend because he called a lot of shots in the White House, and he believed the president needed to keep his promises. And within about 2 or 3 months after the president had been shot, like a couple weeks after that or so, he lifted the grain embargo. First thing, besides working with the Congress, you better find out who your friends are and who can help you within the administration, because everybody has, you know, they have a something to say, and they may help you, and they may cut your throat.
Right.
Sure. Yeah. In light of, I think what Jack said is very important. The new president, a new Secretary of Agriculture, better get with Rahm Emanuel, one of the first things he does, because this is one tough cookie who's White House Chief of Staff. If you're a friend of his, you're going to get access, and you're going to get things done, and you're going to get the president's ear. The second thing is you got to figure out a way very quickly to have a rapport with the president, because after all, he can make things happen. And I'll never forget, we'd send weekly reports to the president. I think probably everybody would do that kind of thing. I quickly learned that if I put things in about Arkansas at the top of the memo to the president, I would usually get a response back. I'll never forget, we dedicated a water and sewer project near Pine Bluff. And so I put that before changing the loan rate on soybeans or something. I figured that he'd be more interested in that. And it got back a note. Glickman, Clinton used to, it was a left-handed guy, and he scrawled. And I said, what does this say? And it says, next time you go to Pine Bluff, call Harvey Joe Sanner and find out what he thinks about this problem. And the only reason I mention that is because all the presidents have, you know, they're human beings and they got interests, and work them as much as you can so you can build personal rapport so that when you see them, you can say, Mr. President, will you lift this grain embargo? Sure. And you know, he'll listen to you.
Can I add one quick point, too, Raj? And this is the USDR related rather than the USDA, but it may have some applicability there, too. When I became USDR, which was back in 1985, all heck was breaking loose on the trade front, a little bit like it is now, with a gigantic trade deficit and a lot of things. And I felt we really had to put together a first-rate team and had to put it together fast. What I did at that time, I picked three private sector people who had excellent knowledge of international trade and trade policy, and also who had clout at the White House. And I had them help me put together the USTR team. And we picked every political appointee that we selected at USTR, presented them to the White House, and the White House signed off on them. And that's how we got a really first-rate team in place at that time.
Okay.
Charlie. You know, Mike, you said pay homage to the House. I wouldn't quite put it that way, but it's not by accident I'm sitting up where I'm sitting here today.
Exactly right.
But you mentioned Ed Madigan, too, and I just have to share this little story because talk about returning phone calls, Dan. When Ed got sworn in, I called him to congratulate him. He took my call, and he said, Charlie, I appreciate your call, but I'm too busy right now. I'm sitting down in this big office all by myself. I'm freezing to death, and nobody knows how to turn up the heat. I got to go. Hung up. Next day, he called me back, and he said, we got the heat on. Thank you for your call. But that was Ed Madigan, those of you that
it
knew
was Ed
him.
Madigan. Yes.
Now we're getting into the spirit of what we really want to do, and we don't want to go 1-1 and all of this. And y'all hadn't answered either one of the questions that we've asked you thus far anyway, so just keep doing it like you're doing it. But the next question for you is, what are the top 5 challenges facing U.S. agriculture moving forward today?
We really want to have them pick one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. Can I? You pick one, and let's see if we can. So we have 5. Let's start with Bob.
Yeah. The largest part of our cost tied to the cost of energy, and this is whiplashing is something fierce. I mean, energy costs are reflected in the price of fertilizer. It takes 50,000 feet of natural gas to make a ton of ammonia. It's the cost of diesel fuel for the machinery. It's the cost of trucking to market. It's the cost of processing the grains and other commodities when they get to market. The cost of manufacturing food products. And the consumer wants them fresh, and so we spend a lot of money getting bread there overnight. And the food safety requirements are stiff and necessary, but it all takes energy, and as a result, We have the most energy-intensive food supply system in the world, and there's really nothing we can do that an individual farm family can do anything about this. This is something that has to be looked at.
Well, I think just following up a little bit on what Bob said, you know, we're in a period now of immense volatility in the agricultural industry. It's always pretty volatile, but I think it's even more volatile now than it's ever been. And I think farmers here and in other countries are really struggling figuring out how to handle this. When you get crude oil going up to 150 and then back down to 150, back down to 50, and having that reflected in fertilizer prices, and the question is, you know, did you buy your fertilizer when it was way up here, or did you buy it down here? That makes a gigantic difference. It makes a difference in your productivity, and when you're selling on that same kind of curve, too. Nick Smith was just in here a little bit ago saying he sold half his corn at a really high price. He wishes he'd sold the other half. So does every other farmer, and most of them probably haven't sold as much as you did, Nick. So, you know, both on the selling end and on the cost containment end, this is really a big challenge. And farmers are going to have to deal with it everywhere. I just did a speech here yesterday, as you know, Charlie, to this transportation conference, and I pointed out in Brazil that I'd read a piece which indicated the Brazilian farmers have cut back, half of Brazil's farmers have cut back half of their fertilizer usage because they can't get any credit, which is another issue that's come onto the scene. And at the same time, those same farmers have also cut back on paying for their machinery. They went out and bought a lot of high-priced machinery when the prices went sky high. Now they can't make their payments on the machinery because they want to buy fertilizer and seed and fuel, and as a consequence, their machinery is getting repossessed. Well, I don't think we've got a problem of that magnitude here in the U.S., but we really do have an issue of immense volatility that's probably not going to change anytime soon, and we've got a major adjustment to that.
Yeah, to our farmers and also our bankers are a little concerned about that. Mike?
Thank you, Charlie. Now, Arbor already spoken about the need for new markets and following in the consumer tastes wherever they lead the producers. But I'd like to just mention something that hadn't been mentioned here before as a supreme concern of mine. We can sit here as former secretaries to talk about farm policy and farm programs, but within the population of the United States, only 2% are farmers, but 100% are eaters. And in that context, I just have to say that we need to pay more attention to the food safety issues in the United States. Again, as a former secretary, I, like others here, we've made the speeches. Our, you know, food supply is the purest, safest in the world. But I've got to tell you, I've got increasing doubts about it, to be honest with you. You see the demonstrations in South Korea against the import of some of our beef and pork products. We've seen the greater incidence of recalls of our meat. So many of them, even though we have 24/7 media reporting on all of this, a lot of it still falls through the holes and through the loops. I just got to believe that. Whether it's one single food agency to ensure food safety, I'm not calling for that today, but I've got to say we've got to seriously consider that. I would think that if that came to be, it should probably be at USDA with its credibility or with its staff there, but we've got to do more there. And lastly, I want to say that it sticks with me because 3 days after I was sworn in, I had to fly to Washington State to sit beside parents of a deceased girl who had died from eating tainted hamburger meat at a fast food franchise restaurant from hemolytic uremic poisoning. And that sticks with me. I'm passionate about it. I pay a lot of attention to it. And I think there has to be much, much more that USDA could do to make sure we can ensure the safety of our food supply. And that's more regulation at the base end. But at the top end, there can't be a ceiling cap either. And by that I mean that just as I talk about following market signals for producers, We ought to also follow market segments for consumers. If there's a retail manufacturer of a food item who believes he or she has a new technology that can certify the purity of whatever they're producing, and they want to say that and they want to label it, and they want to suffer the risk of a lawsuit if what they've guaranteed isn't so, I say let them do it. And not have the USDA put its imprimatur on there so that they cannot follow these free market signals. And it's a problem. It's a problem. Even so that I would say it's almost an imperial attitude that we have here in the United States regarding the safety of our food supply, regarding the exportation of it to other countries, and the lack of our government in allowing our private manufacturers to do what they need to do to sell their products, guaranteeing its freshness and safety.
Okay, we've had energy, we've had volatility, we've had food safety. Dan, what do you add to that list?
I certainly would talk about credit, because agriculture is the most credit-sensitive part of our economy. And I recall in the late 80s on the Ag Committee when we dealt with the farm credit system and how to, quote, bail that out. And I certainly hope that that part of the American credit system is secure.
That's good.
But I have to tell you that we could be a house of cards, too. And, you know, you can't totally segregate one segment of the American economy for the other. So this tightness of credit that we've seen in the banking system is clearly a potential cataclysmic problem for agriculture in terms of the need to borrow money to do what a farmer or anybody else in the business needs to do. So agriculture is not segregated from the problems of the rest of the economy right now, and we can't think of ourselves in that way. I just would add two quick things, however. In addition to that, the two largest parts of the USDA budget are, historically, are the Forest Service. Coming from Kansas, we had four trees in our state, so I didn't have a lot of knowledge about that. But we can't forget that there are about 40,000 employees in the U.S. Forest Service, and that becomes a very serious issue for any Secretary of Agriculture. And those of us who didn't come from resource-prone areas had to deal with those issues and related conservation and environmental issues, which are up there as well. And the final thing, I want to go back to this thing. This is the food nutrition budget is the biggest part of the department's budget. Mm. And we are in for about 2 years of between 8 to 10% unemployment in this country. USDA will be the focal point of the safety net. This morning there was a show on the Today Show, some of you may have seen it, where a child almost died because the mother didn't have enough money to buy infant formula, so they diluted it with water. Mm. And it turns out that a baby can't drink too much water because he'll lose or she'll lose electrolytes, and almost died because of it. But a parent thought that that was a way to extend the budget. And they got information ultimately through the WIC program about not to do that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. The department's going to be on the line over the next year or two. I suspect this is going to be the issue that's going to drive the secretary more than anything else in terms of being part of the Obama administration's effort to try to get people to weather this economic crisis that we're in. So that, to me, in short term, is also a very big issue.
Dan, all six of you did what all I asked for you to do regarding forest is leave my mesquite trees alone, and you did a beautiful job on that. And also, when you mentioned farm credit and credit, you know, the example that agriculture set now for this bailout phenomena we're in now, agriculture, farm credit, paid back
the
loans
exactly.
Early with interest. And that's a pretty good example for the rest of the country to follow. Ann?
Yeah, I think I certainly agree that all of the issues that have been raised are very important. I think one of the things is looking at the relationship of agriculture to the three Fs, as many people are calling them now, food, fuel, and the financial situation. And those are all interrelated, and the food and agriculture system is integrally related. Obviously, the fluctuation in food prices over the last year has had a huge impact, not just on our own farmers, but farmers abroad, the ability of poor people to eat, the kinds of programs that the USDA runs. The fuel situation has had a big impact on that, and, of course, the financial crisis. I think another agenda that's going to be that we have to look at in agriculture is the global climate change agenda. And if we're not looking at global climate change in agriculture, I think we will be left behind as an industry. I saw an article in Time magazine recently that the president-elect was quoting Michael Pollan, who wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma, in an article that he'd written in the New York Times about the contribution of animal agriculture to greenhouse gas emissions and the fact that the president-elect said he saw that it was more emissions than the entire transportation sector puts out. I think so. The global climate change agenda is going to be very important. There's a huge contribution agriculture can make, both through the forests, through carbon sequestration. But these are the kinds of issues I think that we're going to have to play in agriculture a very big role in the future in looking at how are you part of the solution. This ties in also to the need to increase both the use of technology. There's a lot of, you know, capture of methane that's able to do now in a lot of the big operations, new technologies. We need to accelerate those new technologies. We need to find research for the kinds of problems that we're dealing with in agriculture. And I think we also need to look at the food safety issues, as has been pointed out. But beyond that, the potential of agriculture and bioterrorism, which after 9/11 became a big issue that we looked at, where are the vulnerabilities of agriculture? And the Secretary of Agriculture has to be very aware of those issues as well. And related to that is the huge issue that we've dealt with in the past 3 years, which has intersected both my job now in the UN as well as what I did in agriculture, and that is pandemics and this tendency of diseases to go from animals to humans. And so I think all of these are sort of some of the new and emerging issues that the next Secretary of Agriculture is going to have to be aware of and dealing with.
Maybe if I could just offer a thought or two in way of summary, because I think my colleagues have mentioned key issues, and I'm sure we could all think about maybe one or two more that we would add to the list. But if you think about the span of experience here that is represented, look how much agriculture has changed in that period of time. All of a sudden, we're in the energy business. We're in the conservation business. We've always had a role of feeding the world. Ann mentions climate change. Certainly, there's going to be demands placed upon agriculture relative to environmental consequences, and that's already occurring. So I think the biggest challenge, if you think about it, is as these new mission responsibilities are added to the agricultural department, do you have the expertise in place to deal with it? Do you have the people in place that are going to get the job done? If you are adding a mission, do you have the financial wherewithal to take on that mission? Are you doing the right things in terms of research and development? And then you add another area like rural development, where literally rural development for our country is led by the USDA. You have a lot of things going on, but probably the bottom line, the best thing I can offer in terms of summary is agriculture has changed. Therefore, the mission of the USDA has changed, and that is not going to slacken. That is not going to slow up in any respect. And we have to have the right team and the right approach to do all the things that agriculture is going to be expected to do in the years to come.
Jack, you got something to add?
We've heard a lot of good ideas, a lot of points. I'd like to talk about a little bit about the energy side. I know we've hit on that a little bit, but I want to talk about it from the standpoint of agriculture's role and agriculture's needs in energy. The whole country needs a lot of energy, and the whole world needs a lot of energy. And the price of petroleum has collapsed, but I don't believe it's going to stay collapsed. I think it's going to go back up, and we cannot take our eye off the ball of trying to find new sources of energy and a better way and better conservation and get us through to the future. And I think the tendency will be to miss a boat here and just kind of let things go along. And I don't think that I am firmly convinced that agriculture is going to have a place in renewable fuels. And we get attacked, we get criticized, And the livestock industry, which is us, I raise my hogs, a lot of us have livestock, and yet at the same time, we're one family in agriculture. We shouldn't be fighting with each other. We should sit down together and try to chart a future that works. And I think there's been too much fighting within the family over this food and fuel issue. We need every kind of fuel we can find. I mean, we need coal, and we need gas, and we need petroleum, and let's have the wind farms, but let's have everything. Yeah. And we got to quit fighting amongst ourselves. And I think a Secretary of Agriculture is looked up by the whole industry and pull this industry together to start working together for a brighter future for the good of all. Because I think it could be done. But if we don't, you know, we're 2%, farmers are 2% of the population. We're not going to do very well if we don't kind of get the whole industry together, trying to work together in, as we look to the future. That would be my advice.
Can I add one?
Sure.
Quick point. I'd just like to add a segment on food security to what Mike had to say. Mike was talking about the need for the U.S. to be credible and to do the right things in ensuring food safety, and that is incredibly important and is something for which the incoming secretary clearly will be held accountable, along with the folks at HHS, too, which will be Tom Daschle now, who knows agriculture very well. So we got to do that. The other side of that is the trade dimension, where we have too many countries using food safety as a basis for impeding trade. These are alleged food safety concerns, which really are illegitimate food safety concerns. And we're seeing a proliferation of that, and we've got to call a halt to that and challenge those things when it happens. That's going to call for a working relationship between the Secretary of Agriculture and the U.S. Trade Representative aggressively challenging that when it happens. We've just had an incident of that in the last couple of weeks that Ambassador Schwab has been dealing with, where a particular country on a couple of particular issues involving agriculture, and I won't identify the country here now, basically said, unless we get what we want, this country wants, we're going to install a food safety regimen that will simply stop the trade totally. You know, that's just extortion, and we can't have that.
Yeah, good point.
You know, Clayton, on that one, it didn't escape me in looking at Korea. We got 200 tons of beef into Korea, and it was taken up immediately by the consumers of Korea. So we've got the domestic, we've got the educational challenge worldwide, which you have talked to. We've also got the challenge here at home, but. And it's a very serious one, which you bring up, Mike.
I think that's true. Oftentimes it is used as a political tactic to impede trade into those countries, and it's a method of protectionism, and that's for sure. You know, but we have to separate the truth from the untruth. But the truth in our country is this concern of ours, of mine for sure, about domestic food supply. And whether we have enough safeguards, enough regulation, if you will, on the domestic side to make sure that we can do everything that we should do. You know, if we're doing everything we should do, then fine. But if we know that there are gaps and holes and problems, then we should fill those gaps and holes. And I'm not sure we are.
I just thought I'd point out that Mr. Stenholm did get a slightly higher chair in recognition of his years of service on the House Ag Committee. I got one just so he didn't feel out of place.
I thought it was his age, but I guess it wasn't bad.
Traceability.
Yes.
Which agencies outside of the Department of Agriculture is it critical for USDA to have a good relationship with, such as EPA or Department of Energy now, with our biofuels playing such a role in farm and energy policy? And again, we'll turn to Mr. Berglund to get things started.
So they'll have to maintain careful contact with the Department of Energy. with the Department of State and the agencies that deal with foreign governments and foreign, and watch carefully the development of foreign market opportunities and know what's going on in the world so we don't get blindsided. We'll have to work with practically everybody, and including the state governments and the state universities.
Okay. Anne, let's start with you. What agencies did you find it's critical to work with?
Well, in addition to Energy and EPA, which were already mentioned, obviously USTR, a very important organization for USDA, but also I think in the upcoming administration, Commerce is going to have a key role in trade because Richardson, who apparently will be named or has been named, has an international background, and I think will play a role in trade as well. He's hearing me talk about him. State, clearly very important on the market access issues, along with the National Security Agency. Homeland Security, as you know, took a big piece of APHIS while we were there. So on issues like bioterrorism, on entry of illegal products into the United States, HHS on the Dietary Guidelines for Americans, and on the FDA, HUD on the housing policies, defense on the provincial reconstruction teams, we were working with them, the development issues, AID and state again, and then interior and the interface on the Forest Service issues, very important. So those were a few that I thought of. I'm sure there are many others.
So which one's left?
Three letters. OMB.
That's what I was going to say.
The rest, yeah. All the rest is commentary, I would say.
That's true.
You have to know that the most important agency is the White House and their apparatus. And the most important part of that apparatus are the budget people.
That's
because
right.
they will take dollars and policy and mix them together and will either handcuff you or put you in a straitjacket or else empower you. And so those relationships with the head of the budget office and the Peter Orszag, I think, has been nominated by the president for that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And he seems like a very, very professional talent. He was a CBO beforehand. And so I would say that is one. And the second part of the White House is the White House Chief of Staff's office. They're the ones that you go to when you say, OMB is killing us. What can I do? You know, I mean, obviously your cabinet posts are helpful and you can work together from a policy-wise, but you really need to work those most pressingly all the time.
I don't know how what President-elect Obama is going to do with OMB. We know who he's already nominated, but I don't think that their absolute dominance will change. USDA is so wide ranging, as has been said before. You know, food aid issues. You work with USAID at state and on rural development issues for any community with fewer than 50,000 people anywhere in the United States. If you need rural water, rural sewer, rural telecommunications, rural internet, rural broadband service, you're going to go to the USDA. So you deal with so many different other cabinet agencies, but as Dan just said, OMB causes the others to pale in comparison, because when you have a dispute between two cabinet secretaries on a related issue, let's say between the USDA and EPA, you're going to go to the director of OMB. Before you go to the president, you have to first stop through the office of the director of OMB. And that person is going to be the arbiter of that discussion. That person is going to be the traffic cop. And usually that's where this discussion ends. Now, usually you have a right of appeal. If you're on the losing side of that argument, then you can appeal to the president of the United States. I'm not sure how the president-elect is going to do it, but that's how Bill Clinton did it in our administration. And oftentimes, whether it relates to issues like methyl bromide or other environmental-related issues, the USDA took one position in favor of farm producers and farm products, and the administrator of EPA took the other. And more than once or twice, I had a chance to go to Leon Panetta and ask for such a dialogue between him. So you have to go there first and then appeal to the president. But OMB is is incredibly dominant. Not only do they have the power of your budget and the passback authority, when they short you a bit, you have a chance to go back, and then they can say yes or no. But they review the speeches. I don't know how it's done elsewhere, but they have a chance before you make a speech. Your speech is usually reviewed by your PAD or your person responsible for your issue area at OMB. And so you have to get to know these guys and ladies and make sure that that you see eye to eye. But you can speak about any other agency on a one-on-one basis, but the dominant authority is OMB.
One that holds the purse strings. Mike?
The former secretary at Health and Human Services, Tommy Thompson, always used to say, the most powerful force in Washington is OMB. And there's a lot of truth to that. But here's what I would urge the next secretary to do. Don't know exactly how the Obama White House will be put together and how things will move through the process, but there will be a structure in place. I have to believe OMB will be very key there, but there will also be an interagency process. It's one of those things where, as a new secretary, especially if you're new like I was and Jack, where we came to Washington, this was our first venture into Washington, it is so important to understand that interagency process. What do you do with a piece of legislation that you think is important and you need to get through the process so you can start working it up on Capitol Hill? There's a White House process that takes you through that. What happens when EPA says this about feed yards and the Ag Department says that? How do you resolve that? You just don't walk into the Oval Office and say, you know, Mr. President, we've been having this argument. It doesn't work that way, you know. So if I were to give any advice on, you know, who to work with, understand that interagency process, understand who pulls the strings, understand how you get through that, how you access that, understand how your regulations are approved, what kind of process you have to go through. All of those things are critical to being successful as a member of the cabinet. And if you don't understand that and really work that system, it's very, very hard to be successful.
I just want to add one thing. Two strong secretaries working together can not always turn around an OMB decision, but three strong secretaries can usually turn around an OMB decision. And so there's power in numbers, and that's why working collaboratively,
right,
getting to know your colleagues very well, yep, makes a big difference.
Clayton, you're
bursting
at the seams almost.
Yeah, well, I was going to make the same points that that Mike did about the interagency process, because I think that's important. And a lot of people don't really understand how that works because it's pretty nebulous. And it varies a little from administration to administration. We had what was called the Economic Policy Council, chaired by the Secretary of the Treasury, Jim Baker, in those years. Incoming administration is going to have a National Economic Council, which is similar to what was there in the Clinton years. But they are interagency entities. And by and large, the same group of people sit around the table at those, but not always. It varies a little from issue to issue. If you've got a secretary of transportation, and the issue has nothing to do with transportation, he may not be there. But if you get into infrastructure, for example, he sure as heck is going to be there. So the makeup of the interagency grouping is going to change a little bit. But what the Secretary of Agriculture has to do, if he or she has an issue before that body, is make sure you got enough votes around the table that your position is going to prevail. Or if not, you got an awfully good case to take on up the appeal route if that be necessary. And the other point I would make to that is that typically the interagency processes are done first at the subcabinet level. Many of these issues get resolved at subcabinet level. And if they don't, then they get raised up to the cabinet level. What you hope, of course, is that you don't have to bother the Secretary of Agriculture, that he'll have Deputy Secretary or whomever will get these resolved at the subcabinet level, which also says to the Secretary of Agriculture that make darn sure you have a really good deputy.
Right. Jack, we've had energy, EPA, state, OMB seems to be the winner overall.
Well, I don't think there's any argument on OMB is a 1,000-pound gorilla. I prepared or we did at the Department of Agriculture, what we thought the Farm Bill should be, and we did it in 1984, and we're going to get it passed in 85, and I took it because Ronald Reagan would have cabinet meetings, and every cabinet meeting, some cabinet member had to present to the full cabinet what he wants to get done. It could be the trade ambassador and some trade deal in Europe. It could be somebody else. But it was my day in December 1984 to present my vision of the next farm bill, the one I'm going to present to the Congress in 85. And I took it there, and it's back to what you said. You better have your team lined up. Well, I didn't have enough team players to win. I mean, I thought I did, but it's because OMB has more votes than anybody else. And they accepted everything except the conservation reserve. We didn't have a conservation reserve. I wanted one because I thought, you know, if we're going to take land out of production, let's take marginal land. Let's not take the best land in the world out, because we were taking land out every year to short our production. So I lost that, though. That was over, came back. Ed Meese said, can't get it done. Now, Zoc, cost more money. If you find the money, he said, if you find the money somewhere, save it someplace else, we maybe can do it. Well, by April that year, I found some money. I don't know, some other program, we changed it or doctored it or whatever. And I decided, we're going to do this. And we arranged, USDA, the whole thing, and going to announce it on Dick Luger's farm in Indiana. And I flew to Indianapolis the night before, and somehow the word got out, and Stockman called me at the hotel. And he says, what are you going to do tomorrow? He says, we didn't approve the conservation reserve. Well, I said, I'm going to announce it on Senator Dick Luger's farm tomorrow, and that's it. And we did. Now, he could have killed me. He didn't. I never heard another word about it, and now we still have the conservation reserve.
Listen, that's a very good lesson, because if you really believe in something as a secretary, sometimes you just have to, you don't say to hell with OMB, but you kind of say it. And particularly if you think you have the president's backing.
Yes.
That's really important.
I didn't know for sure, but I knew that I had a little favorable from Ed Meese, maybe, and I knew I had Dick Luger and members of Congress, yeah. And I thought, you know, maybe I'll survive, maybe not. What the hell?
Sometimes you have to duck. Sometimes you have to duck, and not take a 3 a.m. phone call from OMB.
I never knew administration and every secretary that I had the privilege of serving with comes in and has got a little different idea about doing something different at USDA. And I think we've got a new administration coming in. Chairman Peterson has announced that one of his high priorities is going to be an in-depth look at the structure of USDA to see whether or not it is properly structured for the 21st century and the challenges that y'all have listed out today. So the final question is going to be, do you believe that USDA, as currently structured, is adequate to meet the challenges of the 21st century? If so, why? And if not, why not? Bob?
Good question.
Well, I think it's getting there. It was kind of a dinosaur when I was there. We didn't have computers at that time. But now that's 30 years ago. And lots has happened since. Now it's pretty well automated. I don't know if their computer services are the state of the art, but they're good. And they'll get better. That's really the key, is to stay up with electronic automation so they can maintain contact and get information instantly from around the world and get from information that's needed from any and every source. The computer is going to replace a lot of airplane travel, and that's the way it should be.
Who wants to be first? You got an idea?
Let me say something. I don't know that much about exactly how to change the department, so I may not talk that specifically about that. But I think the fact that every time we write a new farm bill, I mean, all the papers are talking about too many payments to farmers and the farm bill, the farm bill. The reality is it's not just a farm bill. And we need to do a better job of getting the word out that the bill is bigger than that. The food, the nutrition side is 60, 70. It's going to be 80% of the bill. It's growing all the time. You've got, somebody mentioned earlier, the Forest Service, 40,000 employees. Department of Agriculture does all these kinds of things, and yet they say the farm bill, and they're talking farm subsidies. We've got to start focusing on what the bill really is, and I think a lot of times we're missing the boat on that, and if we don't do that, we're going to lose a lot of our strength. I would change the name of the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Food, Agriculture, and Forestry, and I just think it gives us a better understanding of what the department is all about. And I know that's another big hurdle. Probably never get it done, but I just think that the public should know the many good things the department does and how broad our reach is and how important the department is. If we ever lose, say we lose the Forest Service to the Bureau of Land Management, or say we lose our food safety role and responsibility to FDA, you're going to wait around. One of these times, the department won't even be a cabinet-level department unless we carefully manage and take care of our own house and even build on it, like maybe bringing FDA over to USDA, the food side.
Mike, you're the most recent. What's your view?
I'm anxious. Chairman Peterson mentioned that to me a couple of times when I was in the cabinet about the possibility of looking at some different ways of doing things. And I'm very, very anxious to see some flesh get on the bones, if you will, to see what this is really about and maybe even have the opportunity to work with them from the Senate side. Here's what I would tell you, having been a mayor and a governor and a cabinet member, is that you can talk a lot about restructuring, but really the engine that drives any department is what you do with the budget. It really is. I mean, you can have ideas about what you're going to do differently, but if you're not redesigning the budget, then it's probably not going to be much. And it's very, very difficult to redesign the budget. It just simply is. I'm sure there was a day, maybe even during a tenure of somebody on the platform here, where a few commodity groups sat down and wrote the farm bill, because you didn't have a conservation program to speak of. You weren't involved in energy, and, you know, literally, you could bring groups together around a table and come out with a farm bill a little bit later. Boy, if there's one thing I learned about going through a farm bill process, with today's farm legislation, that's exactly what Jack says. There is an endless list of stakeholders. You know, try to change your conservation programs now. Man, you'll have ducks and pheasants and fish and, you know, it's just incredible how many people are now involved. What was the big battle over the last farm bill when it really came down to arm wrestling? How much the nutrition programs were going to get, and they're already getting 60% plus of the budget. Mm-hmm. But that's really what it came down to, is food stamps and free and reduced lunch program and women, infant, and children's program. And I used to joke with the undersecretary who managed that area. I said, you know, when I have my budget meeting with you, I've just signed off on, I don't know what it was, 61% of the budget. It's probably higher now. So, again, I think there's opportunities to do some things. We are a department that dates back to Lincoln. A lot has changed, obviously, in that period of time. But really what it's going to come down to, if you're really going to change it much, you're into that budget. And, boy, there's a lot of stakeholders that are very, very protective of that piece of their budget.
You know, mentioned the Farm Bill and the implementation of the Farm Bill, which is being going on right now, but will also continue in the next administration. There was one little, not me.
No,
it's not me.
It's a little item in the Farm Bill on geospatial information system to do what Bob Berglund started out talking about, giving us the technology that we need to do the job. And that is going to be, I think, the center of the hearings that Colin Peterson will proceed on.
Can I make a comment, Charlie? Mike is right on in his comments on this subject. You've got a lot of people involved in deciding what to do if you're going to reorganize or restructure a department. It's not an easy task. I've never been a fan of governmental reorganizations because I think 9 times out of 10 or maybe 95 out of 100 they fail. The first one I can remember was all the way back to President Nixon when he was going to reorganize the entire government into 4 departments. Well, you know, that got shot down pretty fast, and it absolutely went nowhere. Look at all the difficulty that the administration had in creating the Department of Homeland Security, even in the aftermath of 9/11.
Right.
Anytime you have a complex reorganization, particularly one that's going to cross congressional committee lines, that's a major challenge. It takes too much intellectual capital, too much time, too much energy, and you finally say it just isn't worth it. So I think, you know, you can tweak the boxes a bit in USDA if necessary, maybe improve things a little bit, but I don't think anybody's going to do much more than tweak them. I think the more important issue is who do you have occupying the boxes. If you get the right people in the right boxes, it'll work.
Yeah,
I agree.
I agree with Clayton about moving the boxes around. I would say a couple things. This is a more of a program issue. I think we are going to have to address this payment limitation issue. It may not be totally fair, but it's a sore that is continually problematic. And while the facts are not always as appropriately expressed by the advocates or by the media, there are still some issues there with payment limits that need to be addressed. And at a time when we've got people hurting all over this country, some of these payments cannot be defended. And it's a little matter, but what I've learned in all my years in politics, it's the little things that kill you, not the big things. I'll never forget, I was standing in front of the department one day and I heard that tourmobile go by. I hadn't been in the department for more than 6 months. And the came by and the speaker said, there on your right is the Department of Agriculture, where they have about the same number of employees as there are farmers in America. And, you know, and I thought, well, that's pretty unfair stuff, you know, and laughed. And I tried to chase the tourmobile after to tell it wasn't true. But that's one public policy area that I think that sometimes we and the people in the commodity agriculture just defend unwittingly and unnecessarily, and we need to take a look at that issue. And I compliment you because I know you were very much involved in that. The thing I'd point out more than anything else is people. As Clayton said, you know, picking the right people. When I was secretary, the biggest issue I faced for 6 years was civil rights. Who would have ever thought the department was hit with the largest class action civil rights suit, at least at that time, that had ever been filed against the government of the United States, Pigford versus Glickman. And it tested me to no end. The reason why it tested me is because the department had this reputation as being the last plantation. It had to do with a lot of history in the civil rights in the South during the post-Civil War era and other kinds of things, and it was a complicated problem. But what I learned from that is that the strength of the department is in its people, and if you respect people and you give them dignity and you have the right people and you give them the appropriate recognition that they need and you're fair with them, then you can do just about anything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the Congress reopened that part of the Farm Bill and I think though that's about to the Pigford case is about to finally be settled though. But in the era of reorganization, I think that you shouldn't just decide it's not worth it. You know, as Dan said, little things mean a lot because in this media-driven age, they get one example or one incident or one anecdote, and then they'll drive public opinion against you. The USDA, I believe when I was secretary, and I believe today, that there are too many physical offices. When I was there, there were more
offices in count than we had counties and parishes in the United States. And we did the research, and some of those offices will only see a couple of farmers a year. You know, so I gave you my example with the senator from West Virginia. So I know they are awfully hard to close, but I think you have to try. I think the public expects you to try. But beyond that, I think the future of the USDA will follow the future of this entire country. And what I see is of the USDA budget, the two largest areas are really entitlement-based. One would be the farm programs. It's just a function of how many farmers qualify, you know, and the Commodity Credit Corporation is the vehicle through which the money is given. And then, as Dan said earlier, the other greater part of it would be the nutrition title, which is just a function of how many apply for food stamps. And I think, unfortunately, as has been said also, that's going to go up. So the discretionary, not much you can do with that unless the fundamental authorizing law has changed, which I don't think that's going to happen. So I think you have to deal with the other parts of the discretionary function of USDA. And I think in those areas, I see great change in the area of the environment. And so when it comes to conservation programs and farm owned reserves and all of that, I think that that there should be a greater priority placed upon that. The second, as I've said before, and I don't want to beat this into the ground, but if we have any more outbreaks of foodborne illness in this country, I think that there's going to be a huge black mark on the USDA again. I think that there should be more done with FSIS. There should be more done in that area, and I think that that is just begging for greater reform. Lastly, I'd say I'd like to see once President Obama comes in and the United States decides what it's going to do on its foreign aid package, I'd like to see more done with physical commodities being considered more as a soft aid when it comes to our arsenal in foreign support. I think that when it comes to opening new markets, I think that we're ceding too much to the State Department, USAID. I think the USDA should reclaim more of the physical commodity side to send physical commodities to countries who have people in need and people who are enormously hungry.
And you get the last word.
Well, I think, first of all, I think that what Clayton was saying about, you know, be careful where you go, because really you can get yourselves into some very difficult issues trying to restructure. And Homeland Security was not easy. I mean, we were just literally had no discussion about this in an interagency process. We were just told what was going. And it caused a lot of concern because of the food safety aspects and the protection of animal and plant protection that went over to Homeland Security. We started, I think several of us here on the stage were together in a process that we started looking at how many offices we had around the country at USDA. And I'll never forget the hearing when I was deputy secretary and I was working on this, and you were chair of the subcommittee, and we had a hearing where we were the only ones talking because there were no other subcommittee members and no other witnesses. And we talked about this. And then, of course, Mike Espy took over and began the process of having all this data on how many offices trying to do things, getting stopped. I think we all then continued to work on this issue of making the department more efficient and effective in terms of physical presence. And I think we have to all help to make, you know, more efficiency in the department generally. I was talking to Tom Doerr earlier today when we were at the department. He has some ideas on what things we could do in rural development. But I do think that one of the things we have to be aware of is where there are calls that that have been made before to move things out of the Department of Agriculture. There is an ongoing study right now that the GAO is doing to look at whether or not the Forest Service should stay in USDA. Some of the others of you may have gotten calls, but I got called to interview on this. There is obviously the FDA food safety issues. There's been calls for many, many years to move the FSIS into the FDA. It's just something that's an ongoing issue. The food aid issue is still split between AID and USDA. There's been calls for food aid to be entirely put into AID. And finally, I just read an article recently that said because of the obesity epidemics, the rise in diabetes, the diets of the Americans, that we should not be running the food programs in USDA, that this should be put over to HHS. Not my words, somebody's article, and calling for it publicly to the new president. So I think all of these are the kinds of things that those of us who have served in agriculture, been in agriculture, and the new secretary, whoever he or she may be, I've noticed all of you are making assumptions about men, are going to have to be aware of as we go forward. So I think, you know, there's a lot of different issues that can come up when we look at the structure of agriculture, and Colin Peterson ought to be careful when he's looking at this, because he may get others that will say, well, wait a minute, should that even be in USDA?
We do actually have one final question, but you have only 15, this is probably the biggest test, only 15 seconds each to answer this. Oh, yeah.
This is the Joe Biden test, kind of? Yeah.
That would be more like 15 minutes.
Okay.
If you had a chance, because you've all been cabinet officers, if you had a chance to deliver one bit of advice to this next administration, what would it be? Jack.
To the administration or the
yes,
secretary?
Yes, to the administration.
To the administration, I'd suggest that they stay in the middle of the road and not get off in the ditch on the left-hand side. There's always some risk of that. Some people are pulling them there. I'm not saying they should be pulled to the right in the ditch either there. But stay in the middle of the road and drive down the middle and listen to all the voices.
Clayton? This is an administration that has a chance to really make an historic difference. This is an election that looks a lot like the JFK election way back when, and maybe to some degree the Ronald Reagan election as well, where the young people of the United States got truly excited. Take advantage of that opportunity now and inspire the world and the U.S. And do it in exactly the way Jack suggested.
Okay. Mike?
I'd say don't fall prey to lobbyist creep. Now, I didn't say lobbies were creeps. What I mean is this administration ran with the sentiment that that lobbyists, they have a role, but it'll be an arm's-length role. And I think now once that's – I thought that was great. But sometimes you'll look around and you'll see 10 and 20 and 20 and 30 and 30 and 50, and they begin to, again, infiltrate your decision-making processes. And I think that – if you can just remain vigilant to make sure that there's no lobbyist creep inside the USDA, I think he's going to do well.
Dan.
Focus like a laser to make America the economic leader of the world. Get us out of this economic pessimistic period that we're in and turn this economy around. If you do that, you'll be the heroes for a long time.
Dan.
You know, I've spent a lot of this election year traveling around the world. I've been on the road most of the time, all over the world. And I think one of the most important pieces of advice to this administration is look at your role in the world. Look at the expectation of people all around the world for this administration and what this election meant to not just the United States, but the world, and to see how you can best play that global leadership role.
And Mike?
You know, I spent the last year out on the campaign trail, of course, and I was with a group of very, very solid Republicans in a very solid Republican part of our state. I opened it up for questions after I gave a little speech, and first question, somebody said to me, Mike, if we send you to the Senate, can you work across the aisle? The best advice I could give to this administration, forget red states, forget blue states, forget which states you won, you lost, and go out there and be the president for all of the people. And if you have to put your office up on Capitol Hill, reach out, work across the aisle, do it in a very, very bipartisan way. People are tired of the bickering that occurs in this town.
How about that, Charlie? We got an answer.
That was a good finishing answer.
Yes, it was. With that, we would like to thank all of you for taking part and taking part in this conversation with the secretaries, which we think was a very truly historic event. to gather this distinguished group of folks together to offer up their views as we're on the cusp of a new administration. I'd like to thank my co-host, the former Representative Charlie Stenholm. I'm Roger Bernard, and on behalf of Farm Journal and Farm Foundation, thank you all very much for taking part.